2 weeks ago, at the beginning of this year's Lenten cycle, Laura reminded us that the season of Lent invites us to get close to the things of the body, the things of the earth, ash, wilderness, water, bread, dirt, mud. This year's theme of holy longing, holy feast, reminds us that our relationship with each other and with God are embedded in our bodies, in longing and feasting together. We were reminded of those certainties that all humans in all times and in all places have shared. We were born, we die. And while we live, we drink water. We're invited today to the water. We're invited to pause and to celebrate water as metaphor and as reality, as liquid that enters our bodies. We're invited to feel our deep thirst and to wonder at the coolness and clearness of this gift that is offered us, to rejoice all the way down as we receive it. And we accept, we nod politely, yes, we are deeply grateful for this gift. Yes, we know that we must drink or we will die, but, you know, it's just water. Too often, instead of drinking water, we hydrate. We buy bottles of water, despite all the reminders that we are filling our world with plastic in pursuit of water that is no better than what comes out of our own tap. We conscientiously, in cold weather, check off our target number of glasses of water to drink on winter days when the next one tastes almost like medicine. When we gather for our feasting today, nobody will make sure that they get a taste of an especially tempting glass of water. So let's take a moment today to cherish water, to remember. What are times in your life when you knew your deep need for water? What are the times in your life when water brought you deep joy? Here's one of my stories. It's summer on a Kansas farm. It's the last year that all of us, my sister and my three brothers, are at home working together with our parents before we start going our separate ways. The days are nearly always sunny. There are no great lakes or mountains nearby to moderate the weather, so the days are hot. It's a dry heat, we remind ourselves, and there is nearly always a south wind to help us breathe. Nobody reminds us to stay hydrated. We drink water. We drink water with breakfast. We pop into the house just long enough to get a glass being an indestructible Tupperware tumbler, of cold water from the refrigerator. We drink from hoses. When we're away from the house, in the field, or even just in the barn, if we're working hard, we carry jugs of water, and we drink our water cold. We've never resigned ourselves to the natural, healthy benefits of drinking water at natural, healthy temperatures. We fill our jugs with ice. With two full-sized freezers to hold our food, the freezer over the refrigerator is our icebox. We fill and empty ice trays. My mother once told me that the decision not to spend the extra $20 for an ice maker was one of the first false economies of her life. On the list of inexcusable family offenses, picking ice cubes and then returning the tray to the freezer without dumping and refilling is right up there with shooing away a fly instead of grabbing a fly swatter and killing it, or leaving the door open when the air conditioner is on. Ice cubes, though, are not enough to take on the afternoon sun. That requires blocks of ice. We fill tall Tupperware glasses to yield cylinders of ice. In those days before recycling, margarine tubs are repurposed to form blocks of ice. There are those who would find all of this unnecessary and even unhealthy, who warn us that drinking ice water during strenuous work may make us ill. There are also those who drink the last half of their coffee cup even after it's gone cold. We are not they. We got our hot be hot and our cold be cold. And there's need of plenty of ice because there are more than one jug to fill, and they may need to be filled more than once. Sometimes we dress up the water a little. By mid-morning, my mother and sister have placed a 3-gallon container on the corner of the kitchen table where it's within easy reach of the door, and have filled it with iced tea, strong enough and sweet enough so that you know you're drinking tea. By the end of our noon meal, the jug will be empty. And they refill it with tea or maybe lemonade, By the time we've gone to bed, we've emptied it again. Supper, although we've been working hard all afternoon, is a light meal. After drinking water, so much water, our stomachs are ready to call it a day. There are better days and worse days on a farm. The ones I dread most are the days that the hay comes in. Alfalfa is cut down, cut compressed into bales bound with twine, tight and uniform, so that they fit neatly into our haymow. The barn's upper story, with no wasted space, to be slowly emptied as winter feed. It's an excellent plan, but of course somebody has to put it there. And hay must be put up properly. You can't just cut down alfalfa and bale it. You must pay attention to the water. It's too moist then. If you bale it then, it will rot. And not only will that spoil the food, but rotting hay gets hot. Barns have burned because somebody put up hay at the wrong time. So we lay the hay as it's cut in windrows to dry. One good afternoon sun will do it. Only now the leaves, those tasty, nutritious leaves that will feed the cattle, are too dry. They've turned into powder, and we won't lose them if we bale the hay up immediately. So we wait for the evening until the dew has fallen. And then somebody takes the last jug of water of the day and goes out and runs the baler into the wee hours of the morning. And the next day, we go out and we pick it up. A tractor, a hay wagon, the hay picker, it's a doohickey that actually picks them up off the ground and brings them up to the wagon. We stack them. We head home, riding on a load 7 bales high in the south wind. But we have to put it into the barn. There's a doohickey for that, too. There's a bale elevator that carries the hay up into the second story to the door where somebody catches the bales and passes them on to the next person who puts them up on the stack, to the person who is up on the stack, stacking them higher. It's a very satisfying thing to have finished, to know that your hands have laid aside food for the winter, that you've created stacks neat and four-cornered and secure. And it is not fun getting there. You're working immediately under a tin roof that's under the sun, and there is no air movement up there. The air fills with dust, there is no breeze, and there is nothing you can do except get through it as soon as possible. But when you're finished with the load, we emerge, we slide down the bale elevator. Even the hot south wind now cools me as it dries the sweat from my body, and I drink. And for a moment, I feel the beauty and the richness and the fullness of water. I don't remember that I ever stopped to wonder where all that water came from. For long ages, my home had been grasslands, which is an ecosystem that actually is well developed, well adapted to that land. And the people who lived there lived lightly on the land. When my ancestors came across the land from the east, they found rivers few and far between. But when they dug into the ground, their wells filled with water. I grew up, it turned out, over a sea, a vast underground reservoir of water. I knew only that our well provided us ceaselessly with water that required only a modest bit of filtering to be drinkable. Well, so long as the pump ran. One of my early experiences of the benefit of urban living came when my power went out and I realized I still had running water. And like so many gifts that the earth has given us, this one is not always being used wisely. The farmers who plowed up prairie grasses created the disaster that we remember as the Dust Bowl. They learned better ways to farm the ground, but water is still being pumped out of there now to irrigate crops that are not suited to the western Kansas climate. That aquifer is being emptied much faster than it can be refilled, and we know this, and we keep doing this. There will be a reckoning for this forgetting to cherish the gift. Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the water. The writings that form the book of Isaiah come from several times and places. The writing that we heard from today, we know from clues in the text, came from the time of the Babylonian exile, which is to say that the prophet spoke to people who had suffered shattering tragedy. For a brief time, it seemed that the nation of Israel was on its way to fulfill the great promises that God had made to Abraham. Under King David, after years of border wars, the land had become unified and strong. under King Solomon, it became rich and even glorious and moved to take its place among the nations. Its direction seemed clear. Under Yahweh's protection, guided by wise kings and priests, it would go from strength to strength. It lasted such a heartbreakingly short time. Despite his acclaimed wisdom, Solomon ignored the costs his people were paying for his political ambitions and his great building programs. His son Rehoboam, coming after him, barely had taken the throne when the nation split into two. Israel and Judah, which sometimes fought with each other when they weren't fighting with other nations. The Israel of David and Solomon never existed again. The southern nation of Judah lasted longer than the north, but the day came when the Babylonian Empire moved to crush this occasionally irritating little kingdom on its periphery. Armies marched in, smashed all resistance, and marched many of the people off into exile. The Babylonians assumed they had destroyed the dream of Israel. The people left in the land were the poorest and the least powerful. The economy was destroyed. Their towns were in ruins. The exiles would be assimilated into the empire, becoming useful and even prosperous citizens, but forgetting any other allegiance. It ought to have worked. It did work with many other peoples. Assimilation was the pragmatic choice. The book of Daniel does offer us a few inspiring stories from that time of people of Yahweh holding to their principles and being rewarded, sometimes even miraculously. But that was not a strategy to depend on. Resistance was much more likely to mean a quick death. And of course, no matter how deep one's faith ran in the one true God, the fact could not be denied that the one true God had failed to save the people from being taken. Now, when the prophets spoke to the people, what could they offer? They had the old promises that God had given to Abraham, but those promises seemed to have been broken. They had the stories of the people's great deliverance from Egypt, their long wandering, their conquest of the land of Canaan, the stories of the waters parting for them, not once, but twice. But those stories were all about their coming to rest in the homeland, and they had been taken out of the homeland. They had their laws and the rituals of worship at the temple and the sacrifices and the priests interceding for them, but the temple lay in ruins. They had no assurance that they would ever return to their land. In fact, while many did return under King Cyrus later, many did not. And they had to learn how to be the people of God in dispersion, in the diaspora. So the prophet offered the only thing he had. He offered words. Some of those in Isaiah are words of rebuke. Prophets have always been very good at rebuking. But what's much more striking about this body of texts is the richness of its promises. Any divisions in the book of Isaiah are fairly arbitrary, but there is a flow and shape to the words that start with what we name chapter 40 and culminate in the great promises that we heard today. And how does chapter 40 begin? You may find yourself humming just a little. Comfort. Oh, comfort your people, my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and cry to her that she has served her term, that her penalty is paid, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice cries out, in the wilderness prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground will become level, and the rough places a plain. Then the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all people together shall see it, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Get you up to a high mountain, O Zion. Lift up your voice with strength. O Jerusalem, herald of good tidings, lift up. Do not fear. Say to the cities of Judah, here is your God. Not only will the people of Yahweh been saved, the prophet assures them, they in turn will become saviors. From chapter 42, here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break. A dimly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be crushed until he has established justice in the earth. And in chapter 49, it is too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob, to restore the survivors of Israel. I will give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. There is not much to analyze here. There is no scientific rigor to any of these words. They have no evidence to rely on. I'm reluctant generally to advocate simply taking things at face value. Believing in things without proof can lead quickly to delusion. People have wasted their lives and done terrible things driven by the most pure and fervent faith. But in the end, it does come down to this. What will we believe? And we must choose. I remember a younger assembly participant at her baptism recalling the counsel she had received from Carolyn Schrockschenk, which was, "You can choose to have faith." Some of the people chose. The people in exile believed. Against all odds, without evidence, they believed. And they survived as a people. They didn't stop thinking and analyzing and arguing about their faith, as the many books of the Talmud prove. But above all else, they believed. They continued to tell the stories. They kept alive their promises and their commitments and their laws and their faith. This also is a gift that has not always been stewarded wisely. As we're following events in Israel, even now, those promises can be used to turn the people against others. But they are also the promise that brings us faith, that brings us a legacy of God's promise, of God's goodness, of God's gifts to us. Lent can be an occasion for examining our faith, for introspection, for taking on disciplines, perhaps for self-denial. But Lent also is a time that calls us to be quiet and to listen. It invites us to stop and breathe. It invites us to remember that there is plenty, that when we need more, there will be more. It invites us to get quiet on the inside and quiet on the outside and to listen. With no offense to Mary Oliver, I want to quote from you from the poet who has, more than anybody else, given me light to go by, Gerard Manley Hopkins. This is his reflection on God's grandeur. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge, and shares men's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down in things, and though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with bright wings. Come to the water.